we started talking about those people that are enumerated, or those groups of people that are enumerated in Ephesians 4 and 1 Corinthians 12. And we pointed out that even though the lists sound like they're pretty extensive, neither of those lists begins by talking about Jesus as the head. So the lists are not extensive enough to say that they are all inclusive, but they are a beginning point for understanding the people that God has given us. We talked a little bit about the headship of Jesus, and we pointed out that Paul, of course, begins the Ephesian letter talking about Jesus as the head. So even though he's not mentioned in that list in Ephesians 4, beginning in verse 11, he's clearly within the purview of the people that the apostle would consider as gifts to the church. We talked about the apostles, the relationship that they had to the churches. We talked a little bit about the prophets. We talked about evangelists. No, we didn't. We were going to talk about evangelists, but when we get to this part of the list, it should be mentioned that now, in my view, what happens is we start to restrict our vision to those people that are involved with particular churches, as opposed to those people who are involved with churches as a whole. There is a statement that the Apostle Paul makes in Titus, the first chapter, and that statement in, or yeah, Titus, the first chapter, and at verse 5, the apostle is talking to Titus, and it's kind of the background statement for something that Paul is really wanting to talk about, which is the eldership. But he says this in Titus 1 at verse 5, "For this cause left I thee in Crete, that thou shouldst set in order the things that are wanting, and ordain elders in every city as I appointed thee." Now, that raises a question in my mind about Titus and his relationship to local congregations. Titus is not mentioned as one on whom the Apostle Paul had laid his hands and conveyed a special sense of the Spirit, like Timothy. Timothy is mentioned that way. Titus is not mentioned that way. That doesn't mean that the apostle didn't appoint Titus in the same sense in which he had appointed Timothy. It's just that we don't know whether he did or not. And when the apostle talks to Titus, he talks to him about setting in order those things that are wanting in every city. So apparently the apostle wants Titus to have a ministry, at least relative to the eldership, a ministry that extends beyond a simple single congregation. So he is a teacher, and if you continue to read in Titus, you clearly understand that. He is it perhaps would be put into this category of an evangelist, but this kind of makes me wonder about the relationship of the evangelist to a specific local place or local body of God's people in a particular place. And there's been controversy about whether evangelists ought to be working in a single place or whether they're responsibility is to the entire brotherhood, and they would exert that influence in more than just one place. So here Titus is told to do the work that he was going to do in every city, not just one, but in every city. And in this sense, there is some indication that Titus is not located in a particular place. Recently, the church at South Salem decided that they were going to appoint elders. They did not have anyone that was preaching there on a regular basis, and they asked me if I would come up and do essentially what they saw Titus as doing in Titus 1:5. And of course, you're all well aware of the fact that I did go up there. I didn't lay out the qualifications in the same sense that Titus was supposed to lay them out, because they're already laid out. Really, all I did was help them recognize the men that were going to serve as elders there at South Salem. That has sometimes caused problems, because sometimes evangelists don't perceive themselves as under the direction of an eldership. They see themselves as functioning brotherhood-wide and not responsible to a particular eldership. And that has at times created difficulty. Doesn't create a difficulty for me, because I consider myself a member of this local congregation, and thus, under the oversight of the elders, all of the work that I do is under their oversight. But that has been a problem in the past. In the early 1800s in our country, you had what were called circuit preachers. And rather than working with a single local congregation, they worked with a number of churches in a geographic area, and they would go from church to church to church to church. So typically they were going to be with the church, if we put it in terms that we would understand today. One Sunday they would be at Coburg Road. The next Sunday they would be at Albany. The next Sunday they would be at South Salem. The next Sunday they would be at Bend. And they just basically rode a circuit, and they helped all of the churches that were in their circuit. And they functioned without being under the direction of any local eldership. We've kind of gotten away from that model. I don't think it's an unbiblical model. I think the model that we've adopted is a model that seems to work better for us. Now, I understand why they had the model that they did. You didn't have a lot of people that were evangelists. They were spread pretty thin, and it didn't make sense to have them working in one place and then have a bunch of other churches that didn't have the benefit of an evangelist. So those are all things that we need to consider. Does anybody else have thoughts about this statement in Titus 1 at verse 5? About the kind of the relationship of an evangelist to a group. Well, it's something to think about. I just want you to understand that there are more than one model. It's just not a single model for and evangelists and the relationship to churches. You look like you had something.
I was just thinking about. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I was thinking about they might not have a really personal relationship with that particular preacher, and what do they do when he's not there? Because you have to have somebody speaking, or you can just have Bible class, I suppose, with whoever is able to do that at a congregation. But I don't think they had a whole lot of personal time to even get used to it, so to speak. I don't know if it made a difference or not, but I always thought that was interesting. They'd go from place to place.
Yeah. Yeah, and like you say, I think there's an advantage to the model that we've adopted. But we need to understand that's not the only model that meets the biblical information.
No.
There are a lot of models that would meet it.
Dean?
Yeah.
It worked for them.
Yeah, I think that out of necessity, of course, that's how they had to do it, is because you didn't have enough preachers, and it just really helped. But I think it also has a downside to it, and it's the same sort of downside that you get with the magazines that were out at the time, or that happened with the Catholic Church. You have one man who people start following, and they're listening to him instead of listening to the word, or if they have elders in their congregation, listening to the elders. So it has probably a bigger pitfall to it, maybe.
There's something to be said for that, Carol. And I think that's why we've chosen the model that we've chosen. And I think that we've chosen it wisely. I have, throughout the entirety of my preaching career, worked with a single local group. Now, sometimes I go and I work with a different group. I'll be going a little bit later this summer up to Salem. I'll be speaking at Market Street in a series that they're doing up at Market Street. So it's not that I haven't had contact with other groups, but my work is focused on the church here at Tobert Road. And if someone were to call me and say, can you come and speak in a lectureship, or can you come and preach on a particular Sunday? My first thought is, how would that impact the church at Coburg Road? If it was going to impact them negatively, then I probably wouldn't do that. But that's just, understand, that's my approach. It's not the only approach that works. I have known some people who traveled around and worked with different groups. Yeah, go ahead.
We have a friend, Mike Rosser, who is supported by a couple of different churches. He lives in Tennessee, but his work is with Chinese churches. So he travels to China several times a year. But he's in contact with the Chinese Christians all the time. But he is paid full-time as an evangelist to do that kind of work.
Right.
But he's not associated with a local congregation. When he's at home in Tennessee, he attends at a local congregation, but he's not their located preacher.
Right. And I have other friends who are ministers who do exactly that. So any other thoughts about evangelists, teachers? Now, Carol mentions this, you know, this can bleed over into a problem where Christians' affinity is for a particular evangelist and not biblical affinity. You know, Paul did say in the First Corinthian letter, in the end of the first chapter, some of you say I'm of Peter, some of you say I'm of Paul, and I'm of Apollos. And he cuts right to the chase And he says, was Christ crucified for you or was I? And of course, the answer has to be that Christ is the one that was crucified for us. You can't be a Pauline Christian or a Petrine Christian. That's an unreasonable affinity. And, you know, preachers contribute to that. That doesn't happen without preachers contributing to it. And sometimes we contribute to it passively. We say we don't want that to happen, but we really do. So it's just something to be aware of and to always guard against. And it part of that just comes from the fact that the preacher has the floor more often than most other folks in a local congregation. And that's just what happens. So let's look at pastors, elders. And we, of course, know that there are basically four words that are used to talk about this group of people. You have pastors and elders and overseers and shepherds. So these are the words, and we've talked a lot about how these words indicate something about the work that they're going to be doing. But the point that I wanted to make that we don't always think about is the relationship of the elders to churches, to local congregations. So is someone an elder in Salem who oversees both Market Street and South Salem? On the other side of that, is someone an elder at South Salem who doesn't oversee Market Street, who has no say in the affairs of Market Street? So let's try to answer that and understand that I can't find a specific commandment that was written by any of the apostles or any of the biblical writers that says that an elder exercises authority only in a local congregation. I can't find that. But I can find is a statement that the Apostle Peter writes in 1 Peter, the 5th chapter. And I think this statement in 1 Peter 5 presupposes. Now, when I say it presupposes, that's by virtue of the logic that I bring to bear on this. This is a conclusion that I reach. But I think this is the reasoning for having elders that exercise authority in a particular congregation. So let's look at 1 Peter 5. And can I get somebody to read verses 1 and 2?
The elders which are among you I exhort, who am also an elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not by filthy lucre, but of a ready mind.
Okay. The important part of that reading that impacts this question about the extensiveness of the elders' relationship with the church, twice he says, take care of the flock that's among you. And he writes, sometimes I think to the church, sometimes to the specific elders, but he wants them to have a relationship with the church or with the flock that's among them, and he wants the flock to have a relationship with the elders that are among them. So it works both ways. Verse 1, he's talking to the flock, and he says, this is what I want you to think about with the elders that are among you. And in verse 2, he's talking to the elders, and he says, feed the flock that's among you. So I see, and if this is my logic that I think underlies what Peter says, what I see here is elders having a relationship with a particular local body. And like I say, I can't find the particular passage that says you have no relationship to the people that are not among you. But I know that they do have a relationship to the people that are among them. So that's why I, in my mind, have concluded that the eldership is limited in terms of its responsibility. Now, understand that elders have to give an answer for the flock that's in their care. That if I have to give an answer for the flock that's in my care, that demands that I'm personally related to those people that are in my care. I can't be held responsible for people that I've never met. That, you know, there are a lot of Christians in Ukraine, for instance, that I don't know. I couldn't have any relationship with them, in part because we don't even speak the same language. And it's very difficult for me to have any kind of relationship if I can't communicate. That's not such a far-fetched idea, even in our country. I know when we were living in Southern California, there were a lot of church, well, I wouldn't say a lot. There were a number of churches who had a fairly large Spanish-speaking group that was a part of the church. And it's really hard for English-speaking elders to know how to oversee and shepherd people that speak a different language. So the way that they kind of dealt with that was to say, we have an elder who's bilingual, or we have preachers who are bilingual, or some of the members are bilingual, and we're going to have to communicate through them. It's, you know, it's not like the early church where you had people that could speak in tongues. We don't have that anymore. So that was the way that they dealt with it. The way that we dealt with it when there was a Spanish-speaking group that met with us when I was preaching in Norwalk was we let them be a different congregation. We met at 10 o'clock in the morning, and they met for worship at noon. And we were totally separate. We met in the same place. In fact, the English-speaking folks owned the building where we met. We owned it free and clear, and we let them meet there. We didn't charge them anything. We didn't charge them rent or for anything. And then sometime later, the English-speaking folks found that the Spanish-speaking folks outnumbered them. They had become much larger than the English-speaking folks. In fact, the number of English-speaking folks at Norwalk was dwindling. People were just moving out of the area. So they were dwindling. The Spanish-speaking group was growing by leaps and bounds. So the English-speaking folks said, this is silly. They gave them the building. and the English-speaking folks, none of whom lived close to the building anymore. They just left and went to other churches that were sometimes closer to where they lived.
And then in the next town over in Long Beach, Studebaker Road had a completely different model.
Yes.
So the elders provided the oversight, and they had a Spanish-speaking minister and an English-speaking minister, and they all met together, but then they would divide to have their services.
And the Spanish-speaking minister was bilingual.
He was, yeah, he was. So he could report back to the elders, and yeah.
Right.
The elders, none of the elders were bilingual.
Right. This is that when you talk about oversight, there are a lot of different models that you can use. And, you know, that's one of the things that the elders here have talked about with our Zoom meetings, because our Zoom meetings allow the church here and our assemblies to include people that the elders don't know. And that's fine. It's just there's this question of how do we oversee them? They're not a part of this local body. They benefit from the teaching that we do. And you have to find a way to figure that out.
Dean?
Yeah.
One of the things that I think about is that the description is to feed the flock. Well, if you don't know the flock, you don't know whether to feed them baby food or steak. You don't know if they won't eat anything that you give out. So you have to know these people, and that's why you're held responsible. Is it your job and honor to know these people and to serve them? And I thank all of our elders.
I do too. I give them a great deal of credit for considering these things, being aware of the difficulty, you know, of who are we going to share our Zoom meetings with? And that's a question that, you know, 15 years ago, nobody ever had to thought about, had to think about. We sometimes mailed out our bulletins, or sometimes we made copies of the sermons that were taught at a particular place, and we would make those available to other people. They could listen. But in terms of our Zoom, we have people who are they're not just listening, they're participants in our worship. And, yeah, we benefit greatly because Kevin Hickson, who doesn't even live in Oregon, can be a part of our worship. And he can lead us as we think about the Lord's Supper. Tremendous blessing. And kind of raises some questions about the authority of elders. Now, our model, what we've concluded, and I think I can speak for the elders, we've not talked about this specifically, but what we've concluded is that the indication from 1 Peter chapter 5 would be that the elders have a responsibility to the local congregation, and others may benefit, but the eldership doesn't take on a responsibility for them. It's allowing them to benefit. I want you to think about Acts, the 20th chapter. The Apostle Paul is on his way to Rome. He's going to be executed. And when he gets to Miletus, he calls the elders of the church in Ephesus to meet with him. And he tells them, you know, you're likely not ever going to see my face again. But he gives them some pretty stern warnings. And one of the big warnings he gives them is that within the eldership, he says, there can be people that arise that try to draw people away from God and draw them to follow them. And he warns them about that. So, and the other part of this is the statement to, that the Apostle Paul makes to them, that these are people that the Holy Spirit placed in their charge. The reason that he could say that is because the Spirit developed or gave us the qualifications for these men. And if you don't meet those qualifications, then the Spirit is not going to put people in your charge. There are a lot, you know, there's a whole lot more that we could say about elders and about their relationship to local churches. A rebellion against kind of the misuse of the eldership or the misuse of the idea of pastors or presbyters is pretty apparent when you think about the last will and testament of the Springfield Presbytery, what Thomas Campbell and six other representatives of various churches that had gathered together in what was called the Springfield Presbytery determined. They had already been a part of a different presbytery. Now, a presbytery in the Presbyterian Church, and that's where they were, a presbytery has to do with a group of men who oversee a group of churches. So you had the Springfield Presbytery that they formed after they left the presbytery that was originally over them because they were convinced that they were making decisions that were unbiblical. Once they left, they decided, well, we'll start a presbytery that will make decisions on a biblical basis. So they did. And then it wasn't too long before they realized, hey, the problem is we have the idea of a presbytery. We as a body of men should not be exercising authority over a group of churches. And so they wrote the last will and testament of the Springfield Presbytery, and they willed that the Springfield Presbytery that they had created should die. And it did. They dissolved it. It wasn't that they wanted to say, wait, with this old group that we were a part of, they started making unbiblical decisions. So we're going to start a group that will make decisions on the right basis, biblical basis. They said, no, the problem is much deeper than that. We shouldn't have associated together under a group of people. So it's interesting as you look at the development of history, you know, this dates all the way back to the beginning of the papacy. And one elder eventually elevating himself to the position of pope and being the elder that's over all of the churches all over the world. And then you have, I don't even know enough to be able to describe exactly what the hierarchy is in the Catholic Church, but you have archbishops and bishops and prelates and all these different things. And, you know, just recently, the Archbishop of San Francisco has determined that Nancy Pelosi, because she supports abortion, can no longer participate in what they call the sacrament of the communion. And she will not be able to participate, even though she considers herself a Catholic, she will not be able to participate. Now, the local newspaper there in San Francisco didn't write to the head of the church in San Francisco, which he should never have been. They wrote to the Pope. And they said, Pope, you've got to get this guy in line. So the Pope in Rome is exercising authority over a church in San Francisco through the Archbishop of San Francisco, who's over all of the Catholic churches in San Francisco. That happens all the time. Now, there is a sense in which what happens in a particular local congregation impacts other congregations. And the case that I'm thinking of is in Acts, the 15th chapter. That's not Acts, the 151st chapter. That should be Acts, the 15th chapter. And you begin reading about this in verse 1. What's happened is some folks have come to Antioch, and they said, the church in Jerusalem sent us out to teach that you need to be circumcised if you want to be saved. And it was okay for the church in Jerusalem to send out evangelists. They'd done that with the Apostle Paul. The church in Antioch sent out evangelists. That was fine. But when they went out, they started teaching something that Paul said, wait a minute, that doesn't square with the information that I know about what God has said. So in essence, it became a question, did the church in Jerusalem, the elders in Jerusalem, did they really send you out to say this? So what they determined is the only way to answer that question is to send some people to Jerusalem to meet with the elders and say, did you really send them out to say this? I don't think it was a situation where the elders of the church in Jerusalem were trying to exercise control over the church in Antioch. But they had in fact sent out preachers. And the Apostle Paul said, this, what they're teaching doesn't square with what I know. So we need to go talk to the church in Jerusalem to find out if they really did send these people out. I don't think it was a case where a dispute arose and the Apostle Paul said, we need to convene a meeting of all of the elders in all of the churches, and we need to reach a decision. Now, that's what generally happens when you have a conference or a group that meets together, like the conference in Nicaea or the conference in Constantinople or the conference that they just recently had at the Vatican or the annual meetings that various groups have where they decide questions. This is not what was going on. It wasn't Paul convened a conference. Paul said, these guys said you sent them out to teach this. I don't think that they did. In essence, I'm calling you a liar. So we're going to go ask them if they sent you to teach this. So let's look at the record of this in Acts. And it's in the 15th chapter. So here's verses 1 through 6. Certain men that came down from Judea taught the brethren and said, except you be circumcised after the manner of Moses, you cannot be saved. There's what these guys were saying. And they had come out of Judea. When therefore Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and disputation with them, they determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain others of them should go up to Jerusalem unto the apostles and elders about this question. They're going to see, did you really send these guys out to teach this? Being brought on their way by the church, they passed through Phoenicia and Samaria, declaring the conversion of the Gentiles, and they caused great joy unto all of the brethren. So Paul and these folks from Antioch are journeying to Jerusalem, and along the way, they're telling about all the great things that are happening among the Gentiles. Verse 4 says, when they came to Jerusalem, they were received of the church and of the apostles and the elders, and they declared all the things that God had done with them. Apparently, at this time, there was just one church in the city of Jerusalem. That's my conclusion. They met together. I'm not sure how often the whole body met together, because they were a large group. Shortly after Pentecost, they numbered 3,000. And shortly after that, up around 5,000. So it would have been hard to find a place to put that many people together on a consistent basis. They could meet once in a while, but it's hard to get them all together. In verse 5, it says, there rose up certain of the sect of the Pharisees that believed. Now, remember, there were a lot of Pharisees that believed. They're Christians. And they said, it was needful to circumcise them and to command them to keep the law of Moses. The apostles, the elders came together for to consider this matter. So there was a question. And in verse 22, after they'd heard from a number of the apostles, then they decided to send out a letter to correct the misinformation that these men that went out preaching had started spreading. So in verse 22, it pleased the apostles and the elders with the whole church. And that's an interesting phrase, with the whole church, all 5,000 of them, or however many there were then, to send chosen men of their company to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas, namely Judas, named Barsabbas, and Silas, chief men among the brethren. They wrote letters by them after this manner. The apostles and elders and brethren, send greeting unto the brethren which are of the Gentiles in Antioch and Syria and Cilicia. This is apparently where these folks have been going. For as much as we have heard that certain which went out from among us have troubled you with words, subverting your souls, saying you must be circumcised and keep the law, to whom we gave no such commandment. It seemed good to us, being assembled with one accord. So they said, this is what they should be teaching. In essence, we didn't tell them to go out and teach this. So that settled the question. It wasn't a question of how do we resolve this idea of circumcision. The question was, did you send these guys out to say this? They said, no, we didn't. This is what we taught about circumcision. So what happened was the church in Jerusalem that had elders also had apostles, and that kind of complicates the issue. But they had elders, and the elders were in charge of the flock in Jerusalem. They had an impact on other churches. because there were people that went out from Jerusalem and said, this is what they told us to preach. So that the apostles and elders had to correct that. It wasn't a conference that you got everybody together and you decided what the answer was going to be to a particular question. It was, this is what we sent them out to do. So in my mind, the elders in Jerusalem exercised no control over the church in Antioch. They exercised only the control over those people that were originally at Jerusalem. Now, again, this is like what played out in the early part of the restoration movement in our country. You have extra church or bigger than a local congregation groups. Their conferences or their councils, or sometimes they go by some other name. But in any event, it's a group of people that represent a lot of different churches. They come together, they decide an issue, and then they distribute the information. That model is unknown in the New Testament. This is the model that was basically developed, and we saw this when we talked about the Christian Association of Washington County. Again, here's the declaration and address of the Christian Association of Washington, published by Thomas Campbell. Thomas wrote a lot, and we're indebted to him because we get to find the things that he wrote, and we can understand what their thinking was. This was 1809. This is a description of what he thought this council was supposed to be. And he laid out he laid out certain resolutions. This is all a part of the declaration and address. This is what he said. This society by no means considers itself a church, nor does it assume to itself the powers peculiar to such a society, nor do the members as such consider themselves as standing connected in that relationship, nor at all associated for the peculiar purposes of church association, but merely as voluntary advocates for church reformation. And as possessing the powers common to all individuals who may please to associate in a peaceable and orderly manner for any lawful purpose, namely the disposal of their time, counsel, and property as they may see cause. So, you have this council that developed. Dangerous. Extremely dangerous. And it became a major cause of division, which is what we would expect. So we don't participate in any council or any annual conference of all churches. Unknown in terms of biblical information. So questions that people have, comments about the relationship of elders to churches. I have a great deal of respect for our elders. They have never tried to step beyond the bounds of this local congregation here. And I have been an elder, and I've had people from different congregations who wanted to draw me into a fight that was going on within their local congregation, and they got mad when I wouldn't. I said, I don't worship there. I have nothing to do with it. It doesn't concern me. and I have no opinion about what's going on. No, I should say I have no opinion that I'm going to share with you. So comments, anybody? Now notice that in neither the listing in Ephesians 4, which is admittedly shorter than the listing in 1 Corinthians 12, or in 1 Corinthians 12, does the apostle ever talk about the deacons?